welcome. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. I hope you had a good day so far. Thank you for tuning in. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. We had some good company over the weekend, some friends that came for a visit, and we decided to take Monday off, a much-needed break, since we seldom take them, and extend the weekend a bit and charge up the batteries as we are gearing up to start our new live show, exclusive for members, this coming Saturday. So definitely don't miss that. Info and details will be on redicemembers.com/live. We also put some details on the main site, redice.tv. Just go to /live or click on upcoming stream at the top of the site or from the menu if you're on a mobile device. Switching over to today's show, we have Dr. Andrew Joyce with us. He's a scholar, a speaker, and a writer with academic expertise in immigration, ethnic and religious conflict, and philosophy. Andrew sits on the editorial advisory board of the Occidental Quarterly and is a regular contributor to the Occidental Observer. He also serves the British Renaissance Policy Institute in an advisory capacity and will be producing and editing a new journal for them. He's also in the final stages of preparing for publication of his book Talmud and Taboos, Essays on the Jewish Question. And that's what we're going to talk about here today. As Andrew puts it, the anvil that has worn out many hammers. This is naturally a controversial topic for many newcomers. But I urge you to check out our new to Red Eyes section on the website and search in our archives if you want to get a better understanding both why this is an important question and also how we can put Judaism, Jewish influence, and their ethnic interest in context and in relation to our own interests. There really isn't any reason why this should be an untouchable topic, as some propose. We would do the same, and we do, with any other group that has clashing interests with our own. So stick around. I hope you learn something new. Welcome, Dr. Andrew Joyce. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on Red Eyes Radio today.
Henrik, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. You have a PhD in history, and you told me here before we started that you really take a hard and unsentimental lens, specifically at Jewish history. You have written tremendous amounts for the Occidental Observer. I believe you're involved in British Renaissance right now, BritRen as well. You have just a tremendous amount of essays, if you will, in your past that you've written about, and I'm looking forward to kind of talking more about your work and some of the specifically some of the history that you've written about. But what do you think our audience should know about you, Andrew, and your background before we kind of dive into the meat of your work here?
Well, I think the audience might want to hear first and foremost how I came to be writing so much and so extensively on the subject of Jewish culture. My teenage years, actually, is when I started getting into this particular subject matter. I always had a very intense interest in history and what I would describe as a real thirst for knowledge, an endless and insatiable curiosity. But it wasn't always directed towards Jewish subjects. I went through phases of my childhood where I was fascinated by ancient Egypt. For a while also, I was very, very interested in the Viking period of the Norse. But when I was about 15 or 16, I came to discover through the education system, as so many of our young people now do, something called the Holocaust. And as part of my particular school curriculum, we had to study a film that I'm sure all of your listeners have heard of by the name of Schindler's List.
Yes.
And we had to write an essay on Schindler's List after having watched it. And while most of my classmates, you know, watched it and had the what I would call the expected emotional trigger response to the images that they were seeing on film of young children being arbitrarily shot and what have you, I looked at it as through a much more critical lens. I looked at Schindler's List for what I perceived it to be, and that was a masterwork of propaganda. Whether that was the filming style chosen by Spielberg himself, who chose to always have the camera pointing down at Jews, emphasizing their lowly, humble, and innocent, doe-eyed expressions, while always pointing the camera upwards at Germans, who were dominant, domineering, and violent lords and masters. I decided to pull apart the techniques used by Spielberg, and actually in the resultant essay that I wrote for my school teacher, I argued that Spielberg really was no different from what I was being told about Joseph Goebbels, another master propagandist who was quite fond of being innovative in his filming techniques. We can only need to look at the movie The Eternal Jew and look at how he spliced his own scenes and his use of imagery there to see that he too was a propaganda genius. But it was an unorthodox essay, I should say. And actually, I the reason that I was able to take things further was because I was particularly blessed to have a rather open-minded history teacher. The essay was taken in along with everyone else's. It was reviewed, and it was marked, and I actually got quite a high mark. Now, my history teacher did pull me aside one day, and he said to me, "Look, this what you've written here is not a acceptable piece of work. Not something that I should be seen to encourage." But the reason I've given you such a high mark is that in terms of history writing, it is a good piece of work. And what you have displayed is a certain degree of open-mindedness. And more to the point, you've shown a talent for argument. You've marshaled your sources well and produced a convincing piece of persuasive writing. So that was unusual. I benefited from that. I'm sure that does not happen every day in schools across the West.
Unfortunately not, no.
Yeah, yes. But actually, for the next few years, I kind of put the Jewish history thing aside again. It interests me really for a brief period then, and as I say, I set it aside. But as I... When around the age of 19 or 20, I started just reading more generally into Western history. I started a degree in history. I looked into 20th century international history. I looked into the history of the United States, and I became particularly interested in the history of migration, ethnic conflict, going back centuries, if not millennia. And I think that anyone who looks into that range of topics seriously, and critically and with an open mind, can't help but be struck by the presence of the Jews in those themes, in terms of ethnic conflict, in terms of patterns of the political contest, if you want to put it like that, between the native peoples of Europe. And the really the, what was the only significant minority in Europe at that time, it really struck me as a crucial story in the history of Europe, but one that had been written, as far as I could tell, in a quite distorted way, in a biased way, and in a manner in which it just left me completely unsatisfied. And it was that dissatisfaction with those histories that drove me on to read more and more and more. And the dissatisfaction actually grew more and more and more until I started really conducting independent research into some of these themes, not all of which was related to my university course or really in any way to my academic career that would follow. But it became, I described it to someone else recently, it became in a strange way, it sounds like a strange term to use, but a labor of love. The love was not for Jewish history, but for truth and,
right,
and the desire to get to the bottom of these sources. And when one wants to find truth in the sphere of Jewish history, one is confronted with innumerable obstacles. When you walk into any university library or public library and you go to the section that they have on Jewish history, you will find hundreds of books, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and all of them will have been published by elite publishing houses. We're not talking about some backstreet publisher. We're talking about Princeton University Press, Harvard University Press, Yale University Press, Cambridge and Oxford University Presses. we're talking about really the most highly regarded publishing houses in the world. And all of them are publishing these books on Jewish history, and each and every one of them is published by a Jewish author and a Jewish academic. And each one of these books, when you open them up, all have the same kind of themes. You know, Jews have been victims since they entered onto the world stage. Jews have done no wrong. Western society is sick. It is evil. And from day one, it has concocted what they call canards about Jews. And they have used these canards to spread hate and to perform acts of violence and destruction against this harmless and innocent Jewish community. To anyone who thinks independently, to anyone who has enough brain cells to understand what a primary source is, a primary document, really take on board what the truth of the matter may be, these narratives don't sit well and will create, as it did in me, a great sense of dissatisfaction. By the time I was 23, 24, I'd started to formulate some of my own theories, but I was pretty much still adrift. I was definitely not part of any kind of movement. I was still unsure of what my conclusions meant, in that sense that most young people today, if you were to approach them and say to them, look, you are the victim of excessive Jewish influence in your society. Now, their first reaction won't be to say, oh, that's crazy, because I think deep down everyone knows that there is a more than substantial amount of plausibility to a statement like that. But their first reaction, rather, will be one of, I would say, fear mixed with a sense that what you have just said is somehow not quite right and somehow not quite good. So when I started at the age of 22 or 23 to start to question serious aspects of Jewish history and really have the seed of a much more realistic, much more aware conception of what this history amounted to, I was struck by that same feeling of, but wait a minute, where does that leave me? What does that make me? Because we are all led to believe that to question certain things about Jewish history or to feel certain things towards Jews or to perceive in Jewish group behavior, or actually to perceive Jews as behaving as part of a group even, that means that you are somehow a Nazi, a racist, an anti-Semite, or we have all of these labels that immediately come to mind, and they immediately come to mind because they've been put there, and they've been put there at a very young age through our education system and our culture. So this I went through this phase of wrestling with what this meant, but I persisted because to me it didn't matter so much. As I said, as you mentioned at the start, I've adopted a very unsentimental attitude to these things. Truth takes priority.
Yeah.
So I soldiered on, and then I would say when I was probably 27, I had the great fortune of discovering the magnificent trilogy of books on Jews and Jewish culture by Kevin MacDonald, and it was like a light just shone on me. And one of the reasons for that was because a lot of the material that I had read, written by people in centuries past who didn't, let's be honest, didn't quite like Jews very much at all, it was written, as far as I could tell, in a very sloppy way or a very emotive way that I couldn't quite get in touch with. I couldn't quite connect with that. I needed something that had a bit more rigor to it, a bit more intellectual heft. And I think that the Kevin MacDonald's books were the first that I really just devoured and found satisfying on a level that I had needed probably since I was 18 or 19, since that journey really began in earnest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember at the time, after I finished The Culture of Critique, the last of the trilogy, I emailed Kevin McDonald. I dug out his email address. You know, when one Googles Kevin McDonald, one of the first things that you're confronted with is obviously the ADL hit piece.
Yep.
Which I had a quick read, and nothing on it surprised me whatsoever. But I persisted in scrolling down through the results, and I got his email address, and I made contact with him. And we exchanged emails, and I told him a little bit about myself and some of my own research, and he was very, very positive about that. And one day I decided that I was going to just send him a piece of writing. I was very impressed with the content at the Occidental Observer, and I hoped that I had something I could contribute to what they were trying to achieve there in terms of disseminating what I would call real history and also honest discussion of contemporary politics and culture. And it was well received, and really it hasn't stopped since then. I think the pace of my work has increased. I write also for the Occidental Quarterly. I sit on the editorial board for the Occidental Quarterly. And I've been doing speaking engagements and really trying to get the truth out there. And coming on Red Ice this evening is another part of that. So I thank you, Henrik, for giving me the opportunity.
Well, thank you. Yeah, definitely. We're very glad to have you here. As I said, I think you do great work. I don't know how many people, I don't know if you've been counting, but I attempted to do so today. I think we have multiple pages on the Occidental Observer under your author's page, if you will. You've probably written, 40, 50 pieces, I think, for the Occidental Observer over a few years?
Yeah, it's probably definitely around 50 right now.
Yeah.
In addition to, you know, pieces for Occidental Quarterly that didn't appear in the Occidental Observer, there are one or two there. And on top of that, I'm working actually on a book right now. It's a collection of what I would regard anyway as my best articles for the Occidental Observer, but also some new content. And also I've expanded some of the articles that I wrote for the Occidental Observer, because when you write for the Occidental Observer, there's a limit to how detailed you can be on some sub subjects, but when you've got a whole chapter to play with, you can really kind of really get to the meat and bones of each and every subject. And it's very important to me as a writer. One of the things I pride myself on is that each of the claims that I make and each of the statements, I try to back it up with as much factual and material with a lot of integrity as possible. Because we are in an uphill struggle, those on the opposing side will try and call what we do pseudo intellectualism or pseudo science, and we need to really be on top of our game each and every time, in the hope that any right thinking person who eventually does come across our work, as isolated and pushed to the corner of the internet as it is, we have to hope that when an intelligent, decent person does read that work, that they are thoroughly convinced, and that we take that small, that minute opportunity to win them over and show them a new perception of the world. So, yes, it's very, very important to me.
Of course, yeah, exactly. I mean, your work is academic, well referenced, and I appreciate that so much. We definitely need that, because it's not that our opinions stand on unfounded principles. It's quite the opposite, and in that regard, we definitely share the quest for truth. We have that in common, and we're also, of course, on the same page when it comes to the fact that we're in desperate need for real history and objective history and fair history, if you will. Now, many in our audience, I think, are more or less well seasoned on the topic of the JQ. However, we do get newcomers all the time, and we do have to keep them in mind. We also have, of course, both detractors and enemies listening, and I would invite them also to keep an open mind and listen to a perspective that they usually do not consider. So, with that in mind, you kind of briefly touched on this, of course, but what would you say to those that have more or less an official view on the history of the Jews, specifically maybe in as it pertains to Europe, right, of them being a suppressed group, especially targeted throughout history, they are victims? What should they know in terms of this relationship between Jews and Europeans or Jews in Europe? And what would you say to them as a kind of an overview to give them a different perspective maybe than the official one that they have been given?
I think the first thing that I would say to anyone adopting a neutral or, as you say, oppositional position to what we might have to say, first thing I would have to say to them is open your mind. You may right now think that you have an open mind. You may think that you're the most liberal, loving, and caring person walking the earth. But I ask you to set down your conceits. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. We all have our conceits and our preconceptions and our prejudices. And I would ask each and every one of those people to set those down completely, wipe the slate clean. Then I ask you to take the arguments that we're making. For example, one of the arguments that I would make is that you may have this conception of Jews as being victims in the historical past, to which I would reply that if you were to look at the history of medieval Europe, Poland actually would be an excellent example. And if you were to look at the position of your ancestors and compare it to the position of the Jewish ancestors of Jews living today, you would find that the Jewish ancestors would be in a position far superior, far more comfortable, and far more powerful than your own. And the reason for that is quite simple. In the Middle Ages, Jews occupied a middleman role. That middleman role normally was finance-driven. They were tax farmers, money merchants, and one of the main methods of operation that they followed was that they would be in close alliance with the elite. So I don't know about you, but there aren't many oppressed victims in the world who are in close alliance with the elite.
Right.
In actual fact, if you were to look for the oppressed in that society, it would have been your own ancestors, those people who ended up paying heightened rates of tax because the new guy in town, the Jewish population, had just put a down payment on the right to collect taxes. And hiked them, not only hiked them, but had the backing of the royal militia with which to enforce that heightened raise in taxes. So, there are innumerable examples like that, but it's just a small one. You need to completely wipe your mind of any preconceptions you may have about the position of the Jews in history, because much of what you have been led to believe simply didn't happen, and you will not be able to progress to a more enlightened view of your current situation until you abandon those preconceptions.
Right. Tell us a bit about how they gained this position as middlemen, as merchants and moneylenders in our society.
Well, Henrik, as with many of our modern contemporary problems, the issue kind of starts in a way with us rather than the Jews. Jews have been involved in commerce and lending money at interest for centuries, thousands of, at least 2,000 years. So it wasn't anything new that they did. But in the Middle Ages, European society was changing. There were, a switch from tribes into principalities, and then a slow drift from principalities into nation states, and the end of the feudal system. Now, all of this expansion and consolidation of our people required things like armies. It required things like administration, and it required also a certain amount of increasing trade and increased complexity in trade. We were able to cover all of these necessities ourselves, but for some princes and kings, not at the pace that they would have liked. Many a medieval king was greedy and hungry for power. It's part of the human condition. And what they want it right now. Now, for the person that is impatient for financial progress, since from time immemorial until the present, One of the things that they will lust after is a quick loan, easy cash. We still have it today. When a housewife can't wait to get the newest appliance or the newest clothes, and she'll use her credit card to get it. Well, these kings and princes weren't much different. They wanted that fast, easy cash. And they had in their midst a semi-nomadic group of wanderers who didn't have much to offer the surrounding culture. In fact, they were quite self-isolating. But one thing that they did have that they were willing to share with that surrounding culture was cash, was money, at a price. Their interest rates weren't to be taken lightly. But, you know, when you're the prince, when you're a king, nothing is beyond your consideration. And of course, why care when you can pass the cost on to the lowly peasants? So this was the means by which the Jews gained a foothold in Europe. It was the greed and the selfishness of our elites. And unfortunately, we still have so many contemporary examples where our elites are greedy and selfish. And that we'll be happily in partnership with the Jews to achieve those goals. But yes, that in a nutshell is how those communities gained a foothold, whether it's in the far east of Poland or whether it's with the arrival of the Normans in 1066 in England. The Jews traveled with the Normans and introduced to the Anglo-Saxons their money lending and whatnot, and you know, it really, the problem grows from there. But that, in a nutshell, is its origin.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange relationship because the emancipation of the Jews didn't really occur. It happened at different dates, of course, throughout various countries. I think all the way from 1791 in France all the way up to what 1923 in Romania, and trickled throughout in different countries. That's when the Jews were granted, I guess, legal equality. But it seems the relationship before that, Andrew, was still kind of one at an arm's length, if you will, that they had a relationship working together, but they were still kind of separate within society, right? They were still their own group, and they were still largely kept to their own. So it wasn't as clear cut as that. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, one of the misconceptions of this business of Jewish emancipation is that it's like any other emancipation we might consider, emancipation of slaves or what have you. But it really wasn't. Jewish emancipation was a tactical measure. There was an essay written in the 19th century by a man named Macaulay. I can't remember his first name. But it was an argument, actually, for Jewish emancipation. But in the essay, Macaulay was quite honest in his interpretation of what this meant and why Jews wanted it. Now, Jews didn't want to be seen on a par with every other citizen during the period of absolutist monarchs. Definitely not. Why? Well, because the average citizen was in a very lowly position indeed. It was much better to be in the middleman position, cozied up to the elite, and have all the privileges that entailed. Now, that didn't always produce good results for Jews. For example, a monarch that you were very close to might die, and his successor might not be very keen on you at all, either because he's more adherent to his religious principles, or whether because he just has an intense loathing for Jewish characteristics, mannerisms, group behavior. An excellent example would be Frederick the Great, Frederick II of Prussia. He found Jews to be very, very distasteful, and he was also particularly concerned with their tendency towards money lending, but really bankruptcy, financial fraud, things like coin shaving that they'd been involved in going back centuries. And one of the things that he actually did was he introduced a law making the Jewish community as a whole liable for any instance of financial fraud by any particular Jew. It was conclusively effective in eliminating financial fraud in that community. And actually, when I was recently rereading some research that I did on the Mark Rich case. You know, Mark Rich in the 1980s, along with Pincus Green, these two Jewish businessmen who basically defrauded the United States out of at least $100 million in hidden tax money that they'd gained a lot of profits from illegally trading with Iran.
Yeah.
But a lot of this ill-gotten cash, they'd pumped like $250,000 into the ADL, $5 million to Birthright Israel. A lot of this money went into Jewish causes, which all contributed to the fact that all of these Jewish groups wrote a petition for a pardon from Bill Clinton, which was subsequently granted. And I read that and I thought to myself, you know, Jews benefit as a group from financial fraud carried out by members of the group. So why shouldn't they be punished as a group? Actually, that measure by Frederick II seemed to me supremely logical, and I admire its effectiveness. And actually, I think that something similar today wouldn't be, certainly to my mind, it wouldn't be monstrous, and it would probably do a great deal to deter this very harmful, at least to the non-Jewish community, practice. But to come back to the medieval period and the issue of Jewish enlightenment, the drive for emancipation, the drive for Jewish emancipation only came about with the rise of parliamentary democracy, with the slow creeping march of democracy. Because when you have no monarch anymore, or when the power of the monarch is weakened and the power of the people begins to rise, it places the middleman in a very, very difficult position. So the cut and thrust, the goal behind Jewish emancipation is not simply to achieve equality with everyone else, because that's what you always wanted. It is a response to events within the host population. The nature of government has changed. Therefore, we are now going to tactically readjust and reposition ourselves into new avenues of power. And one of the ways that we can achieve this is by trying to get this thing, this new thing called the vote. We need to have the vote. We need to be electable. We need to be appointable to government office. We need to be appointable to any advisory positions which may be available. We need to be part of this process. Simply, standing by and occupying some kind of null and void status is unconscionable. So that's the essence, I would argue, Henrik, for the drive for Jewish emancipation. And Macaulay himself referenced, I can't remember his exact words, mm-hmm. but as I recall it, it was a very realistic piece of writing. He argued that it should be granted nonetheless, because the democratic system, we can hold Jews accountable, we can see how they vote, we can observe them more closely than if they kind of go rogue. But actually, I think that was a very serious miscalculation by Macaulay. I think that he overestimated the effectiveness of the democratic system. He didn't quite grasp the many weaknesses that permeate the parliamentary democracy in practice, because, of course, it's a wonderful idea in theory, but it is so dangerously and fatefully flawed in practice. And I think that many of our contemporary problems are due not only to the inherent weaknesses of parliamentary democracy in practice, but also the sheer talent of Jews in spotting and exploiting those weaknesses.
Right, exactly. Now, tell us a bit about why we should view them as a group as opposed to just individuals, you know, where people say, well, you know, they're good ones and there's bad ones, right? But of course, we know that specifically we as Europeans are treated as a group as a whole, and the claim is that our power and privilege as a group is somehow equally distributed among us. But what speaks in favor of this idea that they do, in most respects, operate as a group and that they have a fierce ethnic interests?
Well, the first thing that I would say to someone who would approach me and say, hey, come on, Andrew, you know, they aren't a group. We can't hold them all accountable for the individuals of one of them. You know, they're each wonderful, loving individuals in their own way. The first thing that I would say to that is simply, well, why do they organize as a group? Why do they self-describe as a group? Why do they cling so ferociously to their group status? Is the World Jewish Congress a figment of my imagination? Is the ADL a figment of my imagination? Have we been making up this idea of a religion called Judaism, which is ferociously ethnocentric? Of course not. The Jews are the most, if I can make up some words, the groupiest group that ever grouped.
Right.
it's comical. I don't understand how anyone who looks at Jewish history, and I've been looking at it for about 15 years or more now, I don't understand how anyone can even spend 1 hour or 1 day looking at this history and deny that here is a collection of people that has ferociously sought its interests and intensively looked out for one another. I mean, that's one of the things that Jews do that I find difficult in some ways to condemn, partly because I would like to see more of it within our people,
right?
That they look out for each other.
Yeah. Well, I think, Andrew, sorry to interrupt, but the problem is that most people don't look, not even a day. Many don't even look an hour because they already have all the answers, right? They know that how they position themselves as a group, and they are a suppressed group. And I would imagine that somehow they would explain this that, well, you know, they need to organize on this level because they have been targeted throughout history uniquely. So this is just kind of a safety mechanism, is a security for them to be able to organize like this. Otherwise, you know, there would be concentration camps and gas chambers built tomorrow. You know.
Yeah. Well, that might be a cozy little theory that satisfies some smug little social justice warrior. But the reality is quite different. When you look at the history, when you look at the nitty gritty of Jewish history, what you will find, and it's almost perverse, is that during those periods in history in which the host population or the monarch or the government attempted to wrap its arms around the Jews and welcome them in, and I'm thinking of the government of Alexander the First in Russia. In terms of having a policy which is that of the carrot or that of the stick, you couldn't have had a bigger carrot. Jews were welcomed with open arms. There were policies allowing them into education. A lot of the more coercive measures that had been employed in the past were really abandoned. And how did Jews respond to this? Well, actually, they became even more defensive. They herded together even more intensively, because what Jews feel most threatened by is not violence, is not anti-Semitism. What Jews fear most is dispersal and dissemination and vanishing genetically, racially, into the Gentile, the great Gentile mass that they imagine to exist. It's been in their religious writings for millennia. This idea that they shall not mix, that they shall stand apart from the nations and be forever a people that shall dwell alone, as the title of Kevin MacDonald's first book goes. The idea that they group together because of fear of violence and oppression, it shifts all of the agency onto the host population, which is to blame for Jewish actions. And I think that is a very facile and very naive interpretation of Jewish history. I think anyone with any amount of intelligence and grounding in the subject can see that the only agency in Jewish history rests with the Jews. Jews are at all times strategizers, at all times tacticians, and at all times perfectly capable of getting themselves out of just about any scrape you can imagine. It's why after 3,000 or more years, they are still here while the Egyptians and the Babylonians have vanished. Jews and Judaism and Jewish influence are an anvil that have worn out 1,000 hammers or more. And the sooner, the more of our people realize that and adjust their tactics and level of awareness accordingly, the better.
Yeah, I definitely would talk about what you just mentioned more later on, but let's kind of continue to unfold the scenario and talk a bit more about the history here. What can you say about the issue of expulsions, right? I mean, how many, I don't know if you've counted perchance, I've attempted a couple of times, but how many places have they been expelled from throughout the last millennium? And what is this indicative of? What should we learn from this history?
Well, I couldn't even begin to count. I'm sure actually that not even all of them have been recorded, Henrik. I think that Jews have been expelled from different locations and host populations from prehistory, probably. They themselves, in the story of the Exodus, going out of Egypt, I think that it's possibly allegorical. It possibly refers to one or several expulsions in prehistory.
Right.
I think that there are, it's a self-congratulatory interpretation and a self-righteous interpretation of those expulsions. But I would hesitate to put any limit on the number of expulsions or areas of location. I think that it has been a constant and prevalent phenomenon of Jewish history. As far as the significance of it in history, as far as the reasons behind it, I think these are more straightforward to explain. In his book, The Jews, Hilaire Belloc describes a kind of process by which friction develops between a Jewish population and its non-Jewish host. It's an excellent book at explaining this in very mechanical and matter-of-fact ways, but essentially, Jews originated in our societies along with an idea that they had some kind of usefulness. The usefulness may have been for a short period to a particular monarch, if they financed a war, if they financed the expansion of a kingdom, the creation of a militia. Some loans provided by Jews also built some of Europe's cathedrals. So there was an idea for a time there of usefulness. But attending that was also a number of other characteristics of the Jewish community that weren't even remotely perceived as being positive. One was exclusiveness. And over time, exclusiveness or exclusivity contributes to friction. And it contributes to friction because exclusivity with Jews carried echoes also of superiority. And people in medieval Europe were aware of the fact that when the Jewish butcher or whatever sold them meat, it was the lower quality cuts. They were aware that Jews wouldn't sit at the same table as them. They were aware slowly but surely of what was written in the Talmud about them, for example. So exclusivity was one of the factors contributing to friction. The other was exploitation. The financial usefulness of the Jews gradually morphed into a sense of being exploited. And, if it was the monarch who was starting to feel that it was getting a little bit tight in terms of making the repayments, he would simply pass that on to the wider population by raising the taxes, which would then be collected by the Jews. So the tension always rose from below. That's where the pressure built up. Now, a monarch who enjoys absolute power feels quite comfortable. He can do really what he wants. And if the nobles immediately below him are divided and squabbling and what have you, it's the old divide and conquer strategy, then he feels even more comfortable. But gradually, because of this position of the Jews, who not only were charging exorbitant interest rates on their loans, but were also a heathen, different and separate people, it added a different flavor altogether to what was occurring. And it was also an opportunity, the difference of the Jews, for these different groups within the European population to come together. So the nobles start coming together, the people start coming together. If they're lucky, they manage to get a bishop or the local priest on board as well. So you have a unification of the peasantry, of the clergy, and of the nobility. And when that happens, the power of the monarch starts to become weaker in terms of the overall balance. There are a number of things that can then happen. The monarch can attempt to clamp down on all these people, and we have instances in history where examples may have been made of a particular noble who was violent to a Jew, because Jews were protected by being the king's property. So if a noble didn't want to repay his loan and he struck a Jew, or if he killed a Jew, he would be severely punished, because that was viewed as an assault on the monarch himself. But the balance of power was crucial. But if it was tipped just that little bit too much against the monarch, if he looked at the nobles arraying against him and the people behind them, and also the clergy, and he thought for a second, I might not come out too well from a conflict on this, then expulsion was a good way to release that pressure. It would be a good way to deflect attention from his own personal greed and his own personal exploitation of the lower orders. It could all be dispensed with by getting rid of this troublesome middleman population. And I think that as we look back in history, we shouldn't be too sentimental about this in terms of believing that our kings and monarchs were perfectly good in doing this or whatever. It was selfish. Ultimately, it would benefit us for a time that the Jews were expelled, but inevitably they would be reinvited by another monarch with similar motives of greed and self-interest, and the cycle would be forced to repeat itself in some European principalities, at least. But also on the subject of expulsions, another period of weakness would be the period of the interregnum, for example, between one king dying and his successor coming to the throne. Lots of nobles took that opportunity to carry out actions against Jews and try and push them out. It wouldn't be a formal royal edict of expulsion, but it was an all-out effort by the nobility to get rid of this troublesome and exploitative population of Jews in the interregnum period. And we see a lot of that, particularly in England in the Middle Ages. Really, the idea behind it was, okay, while there is no king in position right now, we need to act quickly, because as soon as the new king takes the throne, the Jews are his property once again, and they effectively become untouchable and are backed by the royal militia. So when you scrape away a lot of the superstition behind things like this idea of the blood libel and everything, I actually don't view them really as instances of crude superstition at all. I actually think they were the very, very intelligent maneuvers by a people that were very, very hamstrung in terms of what they could do and how they could voice their displeasure at being exploited. And if you could claim some kind of allegiance with the church, or claim that what you were doing was somehow part of God's wishes, and there were miracles and everything going, very, very clever indeed. Mm. And I think there was an excellent bit of logic going on there. But the Jews thrive under very, very powerful elites that they are allied to. And this is something, it's a crucial factor in Jewish history. I cannot stress that enough. It is a crucial factor that Jews thrive under very, very strong government and a weak population. And that's why in the past I've written about this issue of gun control, about Jewish efforts to disarm the population in the United States, and at all turns pushing for big government.
Yeah, very, very many important factors there that you've talked about that I want to get into later. But I know this will be jumping ahead maybe a little bit, but I want to address this before we break here in 5 minutes or so. And then I'm going to speak a little bit more about your writings and the upcoming book that you have. But can you explain the concerns, if you will, an overview of what you, the overview of the concerns that you have right now when it comes to what we are facing as Europeans? I mean, you can extend this to North America too, I guess, as our situations are similar, but different circumstances perhaps. But in consideration of what you just talked about, why should we concern ourselves with Jewish ethnic interests and power, and how does that kind of converge with our interests as Europeans? What's describe that for someone who just have no clue whatsoever in terms of the situation that we are in and how that is juxtaposed by Jewish interests.
I think the best place to start would be simply to say that we are living in a period of, in time that is completely unprecedented in the history of our people, or in human history. I think that the current demographic changes that are occurring across Europe and in those lands in which Europeans have been predominant in the last two or three centuries, that these changes are a catastrophe of immense significance, and the danger that we face as a people is tragically immense. As far as the Jewish position in all that is currently happening is concerned, the Jewish role is very, very significant. I don't think it's right now as direct as some people think it is or seem to need to think it is. I think a lot of the groundwork for our current situation was laid, in fact, at the start of the 20th century, and it really, really snowballed up through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I think actually what we're seeing now is not so much the planting of this rotten tree, but the fact that this rotten tree is now bearing fruit. I think that generations of our young people have grown up in an atmosphere, a cultural and intellectual and educational atmosphere saturated by a truly poisonous Jewish intellectualism. They have absorbed it. It is in their bloodstream. It is in their thought processes. And in many respects, it dominates and distorts their entire personality. I recently called this phenomenon of the social justice warrior the Frankenstein's creation of Jewish intellectualism. These young people who believe or have been led to believe that they are supernaturally good, supernaturally moral, and capable of transforming the world. I mean, I simply look at it and I feel like asking them, what are these changes that you think you are bringing about? What power do you think you have other than the power to completely wipe your entire genetic heritage from the face of the earth? Because most of these people are intellectual mediocrities. They aren't particularly intelligent, nor do they have anything even entertaining to say. You turn on your screen and you look at the average sort of far left processed, and you see a bunch of normally upper middle class zombies, their heads full of Marx and Steinem and any other number of Jewish brainwashers, and they're there creating havoc and destroying every chance that their people has of some kind of resurgence and regaining some kind of sane position within their own nations. But I just look around and I'll be honest, I confess to tremendous feelings of despair at times, sitting some evenings watching the news broadcast as it tells us of thousands more migrants. You know, I don't call them refugees. They aren't refugees from anything. They aren't fleeing anything but a mediocre existence created by their own culture.
Right.
We can't help them with that. You know, all we can offer them is a suicidal symbiotic relationship in which they attach themselves to our welfare systems, in which they commit crimes on an appalling scale, and completely and utterly take us for granted and take us to the cleaners. There is no benefit to us for letting in these people. There is no utility. There's no way of skewing any of the facts because they're just not there.
It feels so good, Andrew. It feels so good to help other people, right?
I'm sure it does to some very, very dysfunctional people who live very, very empty lives.
Right.
I spent a good amount of time earlier, actually. I was driving in the car, and sometimes these themes and these thoughts come into my head, and I ponder, and I just reflect back on any kind of historical pretext there may be for why we are the way we are right now. When I say we, I mean lots of these dysfunctional moral do-gooder types. And as you say, well, why do they feel that this is so good? One of the ideas actually that I came up with earlier was that we have a very much declined sense of what is ours in the modern age, and part of that is economic. If you were to rewind, turn back the clock 2 centuries, you and I, Henrik, would have been born into a family homestead. We would have had land that our fathers and their fathers would have owned. And such would have been the case going back generations. But, you know, industrialization came in. People drifted from the countryside into the city. They sold what little land they had to some, capitalist who probably gave them a few coins. And off they skipped merrily to the city where they took a job in a factory. And they felt so free, and they didn't have the concern of the land and everything anymore. But fast forward even further to our generation, and that the most that we can hope to own or feel attached to is perhaps our own home or house. If we're lucky, it might have a garden. If we live in the city, we won't have that. And all of the things that we feel attached to are our possessions.
Yep.
This is what modern culture and society is. Our car is ours. Our television is ours. The fancy new kitchen suite is ours, but the land is not ours. And so when we hear about thousands of invaders streaming through the borders and they're settling here and settling our, that sense of loss that would have been there if we were still in the position of our ancestors and the land itself was ours, it's gone. That feeling is gone. It is a complex situation. And, it's not purely psychological. It's economic. You know, our world has changed. There's a famous book by the English historian Peter Laslett called The World We Have Lost, and it's full of recollections about times when we all, we lived near our extended family, we lived on the land, we had guests and apprentices living in our home, and he talks about the breaking up of social bonds and cultures that came with industrialization. I think part of the problem, it's by no means all of it. Whites have a tendency to be our own worst enemy sometimes. Some of our talents in creating machines and industrialization contain the kernels of our weaknesses. But these weaknesses need to be exploited, of course, and I think that's where Jewish intellectualism comes in, because if there's one thing the organized Jewish community is very good and has been very good at doing over historical time, it is finding and then exploiting ruthlessly any weaknesses that we may have.
Yeah, it's just incredibly important. I mean, there's so much we can say about this, and I have much more that I want to ask you about, and much more I want to discuss in the next segment. I want to ask you, well, obviously we can't talk about this subject and avoiding something as central to this as the Holocaust. I want to ask you more about that later, and how what position that has, or how important that is in the question of Jewish identity, and also, of course, how that has been exploited in terms of everything that's happening right now. So we have tons more to discuss here. But tell us, you work a bit with British Renaissance. You obviously, as we said, you write for theoccidentalobserver.net, and you are part of also publishing articles for the Occidental Quarterly. Feel free to give us the website addresses to those, so people know where to go, where they can find your writings. And also tell us a bit about the upcoming book you have, and if you have any release date as of yet on that.
Yeah, well, as you said, occidentalobserver.net is where you'll find the vast majority of my writings. I don't really write for any other website. I enjoy a very, very close and fruitful relationship with Kevin MacDonald. He's a scholar that I admire tremendously. I think he's just done some absolutely groundbreaking work that will forge a path and has forged a path for younger scholars and people in our movement like myself,
yes,
to follow really for decades to come. It's I view his writings as no less significant than historical as some of the things written by Richard Wagner or Heinrich von Treitschke or many others in the past who have taken on this subject and attempted to come to a reasoned, scholarly, but at the same time, eloquent response to it. Yes, I'm also involved to some extent in Jack Sen's British Renaissance group. It's constantly evolving. I'm not in the thick of it, but it, as an idea, the British Renaissance is evolving. I mentioned earlier that Jewish influence is an anvil that has worn out thousands of hammers, and I think that one of the good things, at least about British Renaissance, is that it's not fixing itself to one shape too much. I think that one of the things that our movement suffers from is this rash enthusiasm that seems to attend every new group or movement. This is how we're going to win. This is how we're going to get the votes of the people. This is how we're going to roll back Jewish influence. This is how we're going to end the migration crisis. And I see the same thing with the phenomenon of Donald Trump in the United States. This is the turning point. And I think that longer term, more flexible strategies would be far more useful to our cause, and really to view the whole thing as the long game. Yes. What we're looking at here is a problem that has been with us for about 2,000 years, and many, many more intelligent men than myself have taken it on and failed. That's not a reason for me to walk away with my head down and say, well, I'm not up to it. But it is a reason for me to want to avoid any kind of hubris. And unfortunately, I've seen hubris now and again in our movement, and unfortunately some egos as well. But one of the things that I would say about Jack Sen is that he has adopted a flexible approach to the question of bringing Britain to its senses. And I think he's being quite ably assisted by others at the minute, and certainly the group is slowly evolving into a think tank. It's now the British Renaissance Policy Institute, and I think that over time some good ideas may well come out of it, or it may undergo a further transition as the situation requires. We need to keep in mind that this is a dynamic, as I said earlier, it's an incredibly important period in our history, but it's also very, very dynamic. The situation is changing constantly, and things are being thrown up that not even our enemies have anticipated. I don't think for one second that the Donald Trump phenomenon is something that was on the Jewish playbook. I think that they've been placed in a very, very uncomfortable position. If not so much by Trump, who of course has a Jewish son-in-law, then by Trumpism. They fear that some of the themes that he's raising, the style of his rhetoric, this kind of, it's in some ways it's like Trump is kind of like a mega troll. You know, some of the things that he's come out with are really riling people up. That is to Jews akin to some kind of Pandora's box that threatens to swallow them whole. This is viewed with great trepidation, and will be met over time with I'm sure very sophisticated counter strategy. Already we hear about Republican donors, Jewish Republican donors, slowly, according to Haaretz and the Forward, slowly opening their wallets to Trump, and this will be an effort quite similar to historical instances where the monarch or the leader was quite hostile to Jews or Jewish interests. To just get in there with any kind of influence they can. And one of the most ancient forms of getting influence is to open the checkbook. It's to shake the coins, you know.
Yep.
And that will be the way in.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Andrew. Let's definitely talk more about Trump and Trumpism in the second segment. There's much to that, of course. We'll have the websites up, of course, to the publications that we are talking about here, the Occidental Observer, the Occidental Quarterly, and also to British Renaissance. And quickly here, now then, before we break, the book, any idea of when that will be out?
Certainly, I'm just finishing the manuscript right now, but the goal will be to have it out by the end of 2016. The book is called Talmud and Taboo, Essays on the Jewish Question. And as I said earlier, it will contain some of the best content that I've produced for the Occidental Observer, some of it expanded and developed further, but also some new essays covering things like Trump and Trumpism, and also some thoughts on the Jewish question as a whole and its contemporary significance, and also some of my own thoughts on counter strategy and how slowly but surely we might be able to build something over time, and it will take time, that can secure an existence for our children.
Absolutely. Very important. All right. Very good. Talmud and Taboo. Keep an eye out for the book, ladies and gentlemen. Upcoming here probably towards the end of the year, hopefully. All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. Stay with us here. We'll be right back after a short break with the second hour. Much more to get into. We'll talk to you on the other side. Well, when we return with the second hour, we'll address the concern that there tends to be an unhealthy obsession with the JQ and how we can study our own weaknesses in terms of damaged ethnic cohesion in balancing this issue. Dr. Joyce stresses that we must find rational ways to communicate to the average citizen our deprived sense of historical peoplehood, coupled with the barrage of guilt-induced mainstream media and academic programming, is leading us to the slaughter. We talk about the great power of face-to-face persuasion and leading by example, along with using humorous memes and trolling in encouraging our folk to adapt a sense of nationalistic pride once again. Then Andrew illustrates how Jews have used a backdoor trial-and-error approach to slowly infiltrate special interest groups aiming to clamp down on freedoms to criticize detractors. And we look at what a massive cultural shift might look like if whites can employ the same diligence in reversing the pathologically blind response to their destruction. At the end, we get into the idea that everything happening now with the push for multiculturalism in the West is just history repeating itself, And if we are to reverse this creeping genocide, we must bring more awareness, raise the stakes, and adapt an attitude of total success. So if you want to hear more, the second hour of this show or any other program in full, acquire a subscription and sign in to stream or download. You can also watch our Insight episodes, films, videos, and of course the new upcoming live show. Just as I mentioned at the start, the first one of our weekly wrap-up shows begins this Saturday at redicemembers.com. So don't miss it. More info available on the websites here too. Also, upcoming on the show, we have Julian Langness and also Andrew Fraser. Also, Lana did recording with Evalion here a day or so ago for 314. There will be a video version of that show available for members, but audio version of this available, as usual, both for members and non-members. All right, we'll be right back. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Hour two with Andrew Joyce is next up.